You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello there, Stephen Tellis. How are you?
I am doing fine, except for a near brush with amputation from Thanksgiving cooking accident. I am otherwise all here.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that you survived that. This is Glenn Lowry, by the way, to anyone who is listening and who cares to know. You've tuned in to the Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. I'm a professor of economics at Brown University, and I'm talking with Stephen Tellis. And Stephen Tellis is an extraordinary political scientist who teaches at Johns Hopkins University and is a longtime colleague and associate of mine, whom I'm happy to welcome to the Glenn Show, and who apparently survived a cooking accident over the Thanksgiving break. I'm so glad that he did survive.
I'm here. I should also let you know that I'm a senior fellow at the Niskanen Center, along with a bunch of people who some of your Blogging Heads viewers may know, like Will Wilkinson and Brink Lindsey, and happy to be there.
These are intellectuals of a libertarian stripe, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we have a lot of conversations about how to describe them. A lot of them came out of libertarianism. Jerry Taylor, who founded the Niskanen Center, was one of the head people who did global warming issues there. Brink Lindsey was a vice president there. Will Wilkinson worked there. But I think all of them have sort of started to distance themselves in small or large part from at least a lot of what we think libertarianism at least used to be.
Why don't you tell the audience, because I would benefit from hearing this, who Bill Niskanen was and why that center is a significant institution?
So the story of being named after Niskanen is a little bit of a shaggy dog story. Bill Niskanen was a central figure in the Cato Institute. He had been the head of the Council of Economic Advisors under Reagan. He'd previously been the chief economist for the Ford Motor Company. He was known for being very honest, almost to a fault, in a way that many other people were not. And a lot of the people who were around who are now around the Niskanen Center knew or were close to Bill Niskanen during his lifetime. Now, again, Niskanen was a much more hardline, small government man than the people at Niskanen at least have become. We're all still believers in some degree of free markets. We're skeptical of regulation. We're skeptical to some degree of the how efficacious government is, but we have a fairly capacious definition of what social justice requires, and that creates a kind of, I think, interesting tension around the shop. That is, if you have a fairly Rawlsian conception of social justice, but you think that government is not always a very efficacious way to act on that that definition of social justice, then you get into interesting and complex empirical questions that often people both on the left and right try and avoid.
Well said, Stephen. Well said. It reminds me of Jean Tirole's book, Economics for the Common Good, which Princeton University Press has just published, as you may know. In that, Jean Tirole, a French economist who's mainly a technician working at the frontiers of mathematical modeling of various economic phenomena, is also French. And as it happens, that tends to correlate a little bit with the social justice commitment and the idea that a Rawlsian approach, this is the approach that we design institutions and society with an eye toward what we would want them to be if we didn't know who we're going to end up being in society in terms of our abilities and our social placement and so on. This kind of idea is very, comforting to Jean Tirole. And in this book, after having set out a social justice framework of that sort, he proceeds as a green eyeshade economist to observe that government is often extremely inefficient in its ability to deliver the kinds of services and protections and supports that a Rawlsian vision would require. So he kind of navigates, I think, in somewhat similar territory to that you're working in.
Yeah, I should also mention, not accidentally, that I have a new book out with Brink Lindsey called The Captured Economy. that actually addresses some of these. There it is, available in all better bookstores and even some not very good bookstores. And it's actually related to this point because usually the way economists think about this, and this goes in the book, we say this goes, you know, certainly all the way back to Okun and inequality and efficiency, is the idea that is that you know, markets produce inequality naturally. That's a desire. That's in some sense at least desirable effect of markets. And the greater the extent of markets, the greater the extent of inequality. And therefore, the question is, well, how good is government at correcting for that? And one of the arguments we make in the book is, if you look at the exploding inequality of the last 30 or 35 years, it's not really primarily a story about government not doing enough by way of redistribution or investing in human capital. There's a strong story that inequality is not a natural byproduct of markets, but is a product of increasing capture of government by the wealthy and the well organized. And we have lots of cases in the book that piece this out. And that tells a somewhat different story than, again, the one that usually comes out of Rawls, which is there's lots of inequality produced in the market and then government has an obligation to counteract it. We're talking a lot about what you might think of as pre-tax inequality that's produced by government. And so if you think about it in what you describe as that Tyrolean kind of way, government at least has an obligation not to make things worse before it goes about having an obligation to make things better. And our book is looking at all the ways that government, at least where distribution is concerned, is actively making things worse.
Let me just add, for the benefit of those in the audience who haven't read everything written by economists and political scientists about inequality in the last half century, that your reference to Okun is Arthur Okun.
Yes.
The book is called Equality versus Efficiency, The Big Trade-Off. And it's a classic, although my God, it's got to be 40 years old by now, Stephen.
Yeah, it was one of those great mid-70s Brookings books. Like these.
I have to tell you that book inspired me a little bit in my PhD dissertation, which you didn't ask about, but I'm going to regale you with an account of nonetheless, in which I write down in the fashion of a modern MIT-type economist, I was trained at MIT, a mathematical model aimed at showing that the trade-off between equality and efficiency isn't quite as stark as one might imagine, in that many interventions that the government might contemplate that improve efficiency, in particular efficiency in the access of low-wealth people to resources to enhance the productivities of their children, would also have the effect of reducing inequality. And there are other arguments in that vein, but the trade-off isn't as stark as one might imagine. But enough about me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's obviously one of the and Okun sort of mentions that, right? He says, look, you know, this is not a hard iron law, right? There are exceptions or areas where greater efficiency would have where greater inequality or greater measures to reduce inequality would have desirable efficiency effects. But for the most part, he thinks that's the underlying trade-off and that people should actually have to deal with it fairly squarely. And the big point you make in the book is the role of government in the production of pre-redistribution inequality changed a lot between the period that Okun wrote and the period that we're talking about now, right? And obviously, there's some of that is a result of the fact that we've had some kinds of deregulation, right? Globalization is a form of deregulation. By increasing the scope of the market, you create lots more opportunity for inequality because people are selling their products globally. But again, if you look at a lot of the areas of the people who are in the 1%, they're in pervasively regulated areas of the market.
It.
And we don't necessarily want to get onto all the details on this one, this episode. But I do think it.
Hold on a minute. Let's just try to do one thing at a time.
Okay.
I want to make sure that I understand and the audience understands the general overview that you're giving, which it sounds like you're saying that there's rent-seeking activities of which government is a intermediary or a principal actor. Through political influence, people can get the rules of the game so changed that given their positions, they can earn extra competitive returns on their resources, and government plays a role in that. And then there's redistributive activity, which the government can engage in, like the tax policy debate that we're having right now. And if I understand you, and I'm really asking, you want to call greater attention to the ways that government acts so as to abet rent-seeking, which benefits people who are already well-positioned, and in that way exacerbates inequality.
Yep, that's exactly right. Of course, the two things are they intersect, right? The greater the inequality you have in the original distribution, the one before redistribution, the harder the redistributive side of government has to work, right? The more taxes it has to raise in order to redistribute to counteract whatever inequality you have as a result of market outcomes. And so one of the arguments we have is you at least don't want to make the government's job on the redistributive side harder than it has to be. And in area after area, we talk about finance and intellectual property, occupational licensing, the housing market. All of those are areas where, again, you can either choose, if you're a neoclassical economist like Glenn Lowry, you can call those rents. If you're an institutional economist, you could call those the distributive effects of different institutional arrangements. I think for our purpose, it doesn't really make a difference which one you call it, although you could go down that rabbit hole if you'd like to. But the big point, I think, is that we're trying to create a somewhat different frame for the conversation we have about inequality, to get people looking at different things than they usually look at, and to get around the sort of completely polarized conversation that we've had around the inequality debate, which is almost immediately gets you just into what's the scale of redistributive measures that make sense. And while I think that's...
I just want to interject something, and we ought to have a proper and full-throated conversation about your book once I've had a chance to read it. But here's a thought. The thought is that people talk about the 1% and even about the 1% of the 1%. John Romer, the political economist at Yale, he was up here at Brown recently debating Andre Schleifer. Okay, Andre Schleifer is the economist at Harvard University who is, I think you would say, a free market champion. I think it's fair enough to say that. Schleifer and Romer is a self-avowed Marxist intellectual who is a very serious scholar, very serious social scientist who's produced books and articles over the years that have had a big influence in political philosophy and political theory as well as in economics. In any case, the 1% and the 1% of the 1%, and Romer was emphasizing the concentration of wealth in the very, very rich, the mega rich, and so on, and of course that's an issue. But listening to you, I'm getting the feeling that another kind of issue will also be about protections for the middle and upper middle class that are built into our tax code and into our regulatory structures and whatnot, about zoning laws that allow people to create communities in which they can husband or hoard public goods to their own class at perhaps the expense of those who are less advantaged, and things of that kind, the deductibility of the home mortgage interest, which subsidizes people who've got enough money to put down 20% on a home and end up getting a tax benefit from the interest relative to renters who are not able to get that benefit and so on.
Yeah, so the book, we sort of start at the, what Romer is talking about, the 1% of the 1%, or even smaller than that. When you look at finance, right, that clearly the financial, the way we've chosen to regulate finance has the effect of concentrating income in a very severe way. The example I always give of this is to think about the different ways that we used to manage housing finance 40 years ago and now, right? 40 years ago, we had savings and loans, right? And they were protected by all kinds of ways. We had Glass-Steagall, right? And what the effect of that was to create, again, an artificial distribution of income. We can always get into whether there's a natural one. I don't think there is. But there's an artificial distribution of income that produced an enormous number of people who could pay small town country club fees, right? Lots and lots and lots of small savings and loans that gave people a very comfortable living, right? That was a effect of the regulatory regime we had. By the early 90s, we had essentially blown that regime up. We'd gotten rid of Regulation Q, which regulated the interest that banks could offer on savings. All that eventually blew up the savings and loans. And the substitute we created, which again was not a natural market product, right, was collateralized mortgage finance, right? That was a product of government, right? Now, instead of having a whole bunch of thousands and thousands of small town bankers produced who could pay country club fees, we had a much smaller number of mortgage originators and traders who were getting the rents out of that system, right? Those are two different institutional arrangements. The second one has a much sharper upward redistributing effect than the other one, right? And I think that's a good example of how different institutional arrangements are going to produce different distributive effects.
Okay, I'm going to leave that where it is, although thoughts occur to me, and I think I should save them for when we actually have the full-throated conversation about your book. Let's see. Now, the reason I called you up, political scientist extraordinaire Dr. Tellis, is because I have been tempted of late. And I wonder whether or not I'm, tempted to do something foolish. The temptation is the following. We live in the age of Donald J. Trump, of a Republican Party that is a little bit different than the one that I remember when I was a Reaganite back in the 1980s. Yes, audience, that's correct. I was a Reaganite back in the 1980s. I recovered. And I'm now whatever I am.
You're backsliding a little bit.
Yeah, well, only because I'm compelled to do so by what I think are the inanities of some parts of the activist resist now, no matter what, left. I don't know if you saw Charles Blow's most recent column, recommitting himself to another year of resistance. And I'm not asking you to comment on it because you do, after all, have to work in the hothouse of Washington, D.C. politics. I'll simply comment by saying that when I see some of the vituperation and the kind of rabid, kind of maddening excitation and over-the-top kind of reaction to the drift of populist influence in American politics in 2017, it does drive me a little bit back into the position that I was in during the Reagan era, because I'm thinking that these guys ain't got nothing. All they got is a screech and a scream. Why don't they talk about policy? Why don't they actually engage with the debate over the ideas? It's all a bunch of name-calling and sort of, you know, Trump is a bad guy, you know, whatever. I mean, what about the people who elected him, and what about 2020, et cetera, et cetera? Right. But yeah.
Anyways, Charles Blow, last time I checked, has no army or seat in Congress. So, and I do worry sometimes that people who are more or less in our position, who are people not of great ideological zeal, can get sent over the top by the environment in universities. Right, the number of things you have to listen to every day that just seem to violate ordinary principles of rational policy or rational analytical thought. There's obviously a lot of signaling of moral purity involved in universities, because you're surrounded by 20-year-olds, right, for whom that's a significant issue. Being in D.C. in some sense for me is a little bit of a tonic for that, because, you know, the campus is just not what regular Washington politics is like.
Oh, all right. Let me just take exception. Let me just take a little bit of exception. Yes, I do work on a campus. No, I don't live in a bubble. I mean, I got a pretty good internet connection. I know what's going on around the whole country, and I get out of the bubble. It's true. If I were to have my entire political predisposition defined in reaction to the nuttiness that I see here in some quarters of the academy, I'd be fighting against shadows and boxing against demons that are not representative of the real political landscape. But that's not all. I don't think the New York Times is the New York Times editorial page is not a obscure corner of kind of far left craziness. I think it's representative of an important trend in a thread of thinking in our culture and so on. But
right. So anyways, but I guess my point is that You know, the Democratic Party just elected Ralph Northam, governor of Virginia, right? He definitely does not look like somebody who has, you know, who even knows what's going on Ivy League campuses out there. Again, it's very easy to extrapolate from what the more liberal opinion type people think to where the state of the actual Democratic Party is. I mean, the Democratic Party is not particularly ideologically or programmatically inspiring right now, but I don't get a sense that it's going off the deep end to nearly the degree that the Republican Party has over the last few years.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I actually think I'd be really interested in knowing what you think about this. I think the campaign against regulation is a good thing. I think the and in many of its guises, okay, in many of its guises, perhaps not in every case, but I'm with the idea that we need to cut back on regulation. I think that a response, some kind of response to the populist sentiments that we see expressed not only in the United States but in advanced democratic societies around the world, is warranted. And I think the Democrats have been woefully inadequate in that respect, and that they've suffered at the ballot box because of that. I think political correctness in many different guises, I know it's a buzzword and whatnot, is way out of hand, and that's one of the reasons why a guy like Donald Trump could get himself elected in the first place. I think that identity politics, like Mark Lilla points out in that important book, in my opinion, have seized the imaginations of too many people in the progressive camps, and that they are unable to articulate a vision about the country or its future that actually appeals to ordinary people. Asking people to apologize for being white, etc. So that's not just campus stuff. I pick up my Atlantic Monthly or whatever it is. I'm listening to the political speeches being given by these characters, et cetera.
Well, I don't know. I'd be interested to see who the last major Democratic official who thought it was a programmatic agenda of the Democratic Party to ask people to apologize for being white. So I'd like to be pointing to that. Again, Ta-Nehisi Coates is not exactly.
Yeah, I know. He doesn't speak for the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So, except that Mark Lilla gets pilloried. He's a Democrat, by the way, as I know you know, for observing that Ta-Nehisi Coates has his head up his butt as far as talking about the political future of this country and, framing a narrative that can be, constructive in advancing the very ideals that he purportedly affirms. Last time I checked, not a mumbling word was being said, by any Democrat of significance in criticism of that. And Mark Lilla was having a hard time for pointing out the obvious.
Well, let me just go back and be precise about the things that you mentioned earlier. So you said, you know, so one, you know, I just wrote a book that's entirely about regulation, that argued at least certain kinds of regulation are really problematic, end up having all kinds of negative effects. Almost all those are actually areas of regulation that the Republican Party has done nothing about or is you know, actively supporting, right? And I could even talk about areas beyond that, right? One of my least favorite regulations is the franchising rules that protect car dealers, right? I don't know if you know about
this. No,
I
don't know.
Pretty much every state in the country prevents car companies from making direct sales to consumers. Tesla has been facing this in pretty much every state it deals with. That's because every state has a franchising law that says that cars have to be sold. And so you basically have an entire industry of car dealers who would only exist as a consequence of the regulatory regime. Republicans turned out love that, right? The car dealers give over 80% of their donations to that, right?
Yeah.
But finance, you see that intellectual property rules. The Republican Party is not particularly enthusiastic about chipping away at any of that.
Small potatoes.
No, but not all these are actually quite large. Especially when you start looking at, you know, who's in the 1%. All these are really pervasively regulated areas. So when you talk about regulation, there's that kind of, you might think of sort of barrier to entry kind of regulation. On the other hand, right, there's environmental regulation. You know, are we talking about that? Do you really have much evidence that on net environmental regulation isn't producing quite substantial benefits in excess of its costs? There's lots of evidence on that. So this is really a bad idea, I think.
I mean, hold on.
Go ahead.
Let me just get this in.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the choices are not all or nothing. It's all on the margin. The question is, do you build the Keystone XL pipeline or the Dakota pipeline or whatever it is? Or, you know, what are your regulations about coal-fired power plants? Or, you know, what commitments have you made about reducing CO2 emissions and things like that? And there are legitimate arguments. Nobody is saying go back to the pre, you know, Environmental Protection Agency days. No one is, at least no one that I take seriously is advocating abolishing the EPA.
Whatever. Right. Now, I mean, I work for a, you know, partially, or I'm affiliated with an organization at Niskanen that's been arguing for substituting a carbon tax for the clean power plan that the EPA put out. I think that's a good example of where you could trade off a tax regime for a regulatory regime and be in much better shape. Almost no Republicans, at least openly, are supporting that. And that's mainly because they their preferred option is to do nothing about global warming, right? So, you know, again, and this is where I think talking about whether regulation in general is a bad idea. Again, I think there's
I agree with that.
Right. So, anyways, but you were going to talk about how alienated you are, and you want to do something.
I was, but I thought that was a useful digression, and only took.
Okay.
Now we're
pulling back though. I want to hear about your political alienation.
So this is not about me. I don't have a home, politically speaking. I'm kind of turned off by. What I see on the right side of the aisle by what I see on the left side of the aisle, so I'm kind of out there. And, you know, I get a call from these smart, hip, 40-something partners at, you know, firms like Morgan Stanley and big law firms in D.C. whose names you would recognize. And they say, hey, we're trying to do something. We're trying to start a third-way kind of enterprise that would, you know, eschew commitment to either major political party and would try to... try to serve America, they call themselves the Serve America Movement, by fostering good ideas that are oriented toward problem solving, whether it's in education or in terms of fighting crime or dealing with international competitiveness and trade or, you know, a host of other things as well. And, you know, the question is data-based, evidence-based policy assessment and eschewing all the sloganeering and whatnot. And I'm attracted by that. I mean, I find that kind of idea. And the point is, what they're saying is, let's see if we can't, you know, get a critical mass of thoughtful and influential people together who get behind something like this. If we can't find ourselves a candidate for 2020 who could run an independent race of the kind that you think Michael Bloomberg might have run if he had run. Not that he's the ideal candidate, just to give a concreteness to this idea. And see if we can't seize this moment of upheaval in American politics to chart out a different kind of path. And that appeals to me. Am I wrong to be attracted by that? Is this a pipe dream? Is it, you know, they point to this guy in France, Macron. They say he was neither this nor that. He was somewhere in between. A few people even went over to Paris to talk to some of the activists and the intellectuals and the money people behind development in French politics to see whether there weren't some lessons to be learned that would apply to ourselves here. I'm just wondering about that, Dr. Tellis. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a terrible idea.
Terrible!
Let me give you all the reasons why it's a terrible idea. Again, I'm not against, you know, evidence-based problem solving. I'm not sure who the person who actually says we should not have evidence-based problem solving. But even assuming, your preferred ideological position, unless you're going to change our constitutional rules, the basic effect of having any third-party challenger like the one that you describe, is it's going to have a disproportionate effect. They're not going to win, right? But they're mainly going to take votes away from the party they're closer to. And that's exactly why Michael Bloomberg, right? Michael Bloomberg looked at this and he realized that in a first past the post, electoral system of the kind we have divided up by states, the main effect is going to be, to cause the party that you're at, that this new formation is actually furthest away from, to actually win.
So, why are they going to win? Why are they going to win? I just want to know, why are they not going to win?
One is the, you know, while there are multiple different groups who in some ways are alienated from the ideological position of the two parties. They're not the same group, right? So what you're describing is this sort of 20 to 25% of middle to upper middle class, suburban, highly educated voters who are going to go for the, you know, the Goldman Sachs, you know, which is a great firm. I should say my brother works there. Or, you know, highly educated Harvard, Yale kind of, person party. That's essentially what you just described to me.
Yeah, that's my base. So that's our base.
Yeah, that's your base, right?
Yeah.
But that set of, that suite of policies that you're talking about, is mainly going to draw people out of the Democratic rather than the Republican Party, at least based on the polling I've seen. So the effect is more or less going to be perverse. Now, that doesn't mean that trying to magnify the power of the political center is necessarily a bad thing. I think it certainly is the case that our politics has gotten polarized, our parties have gotten polarized, and the consequence is that people like Glenn Lowry increasingly don't have a home. Now, I think looking for a home in a political party is also a little bit of an error, right? Parties are jerry-rigged, weird coalitions, and thinking of them as homes as opposed to places you're bunking for the night is probably a bad idea. But there's also, I think, a lot of alternatives. One is the guys who – and this is not the first time. People who have no labels, all kind of people who have thought about these sorts of ideas before – and oddly enough, they always make a mistake because they're going too big. That is, if you actually tried to say, let's find five or six congressional districts that are especially packed with voters of the kind that we're talking about, in a district like that where you focused all your resources, you might actually be able to elect a set of people of your alternative party.
Okay.
And if the Republican and Democratic parties are closely are closely tied up enough, then at least in the House or the Senate, you actually could be the pivot, in which case you would control who was able to organize Congress. You'd be able to control the rules because you'd be deciding whether the Democrats or the Republicans were holding the reins in Congress. Now, that seems to me like a much easier lift. It allows you to sort of to put your stakes down in the ground somewhere and try and work it incrementally. But the danger in these things is that people are thinking, oh, we're just going to go, we're going to win the presidency, we're going to roll over without having to recognize that how is this new president who's elected
going to get anything done in
Congress? It always seems to be Congress really is the, you know, Donald Trump notwithstanding, is the big problem. And unless you can actually fix Congress somehow, you haven't really fixed anything. So again, that's why institutionally, I think you have to figure out a way to work with the grain of our institutions, or you need to be going out there pushing for a major constitutional reform. And that could be something that a party that got five or six, congressmen in the House of Representatives could say, look, our price of allowing you to control Congress is, an up or down vote on a series of constitutional amendments that would change the way we elect members of Congress or that we do primaries or whatever. So you could think about strategies like that. That would be a lot better the money of the kind of people that you're talking about than trying to run a third-party presidential candidate.
Okay, I get it. I think I get it. It sounds like good advice that one wants to work where one can actually make a difference. The 0-1 presidential contests are very unlikely arenas of success for an independent third-party move. Congress, district by district, you pick your districts and you win some battles, you get a couple of dozen people or whatever, and you can end up having an impact at the margins within the congressional negotiation jockeying thing. That sounds right. Constitutional reform or amendment? Don't you need 3/4 of the state legislatures to sign off on that?
Yeah. Now, again, the point is you were saying at the margin, but again, one point about if you think about this institutionally, the person at the pivot has a lot more than marginal impact, right? That is, control of the House of Representatives is a 0-1, right? You're either in control or you're not. And when you're in control, even if you've only got that by one vote, you have agenda power, right? We could get into all the game theoretic effects of that, but the thing that stabilizes any institutional equilibrium is who controls the agenda. And in this case, that your third party would control the agenda. And they would be able to hold up a lot of stuff, including saying, unless you get, you know, the, you know, whatever the number of state legislatures to pass a constitutional amendment, that we're going to switch our power over to the other party. So if you get the pivot, you get a lot of power, unless the two major parties essentially conspire against the third one, which, as you know, game theoretically would be a hard thing to maintain, unless that third party, like, you know, the Le Pen in France, is so stigmatized that the two parties essentially conspire against it.
Good. Okay. Let me ask you something that's just off the top of my head right here. I didn't warn you about this, Steve, so if you don't want to respond, that's fine. I have a concern, and this does have to do with the reactions to Trump and the resistance and so forth. And the concern is simply the following. So Trump is bad. Let me stipulate that. He's Trump. Okay, Trump is Trump. There are a long list of descriptors that are negative that one could point out. He got elected, fortunately, unfortunately, depending on your point of view, by the Electoral College. He's president. So on a number of fronts, there are challenges to his legitimacy. I'm really just soliciting your reaction as an institutional political scientist to the thing that I'm about to say. A lot of challenges to the legitimacy. The Russians messed with the election. Trump is an asshole. He's got his finger on the nuclear button. A lot of people running around giving speeches, making comments, making observations, news organizations running stories, doing specials, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm concerned. And I really want to be told that I don't have any reason to be concerned. My concern has to do with the damage to institutions and to the office associated with a reaction to the extraordinary event of someone who many people think is unfit having won the office. So, for example, this idea, he's got his finger on the nuclear codes. There's only a couple of generals between us and the president launching a war because he got up on the wrong side of the bed and tweeted something that, the other guy didn't like that morning. Thank God that we've got the generals there. Maybe the generals are keeping from doing this. Or speculations to that effect. And I'm thinking, suppose one day, God help us, a president of the United States actually has to do something like that. And suppose that president happens to be the guy who's in the office right now. The preemptive kind of supposition of his total unfitness, and we're all susceptible to, I can see how the stories would go. Trump leads the world to nuclear war and so on and so on. Gosh, that scares me. What scares me, I just want to be very clear about this. What scares me is undermining the legitimacy of the exercise of the powers of office by a duly elected person based upon negative reactions to the outcome of the election or the characteristics of the person who won it, when in fact we're all in this boat, the boat being the United States of America, being steered by a person whose prerogatives may require sometimes to be exercised under ambiguous and difficult circumstances. And this discrediting, delegitimizing rhetoric puts us at, it seems to me, unnecessary risk of the appropriate actions not being taken or not being affirmed by, anyway, I'll stop.
Right.
Is there a question? Do you see what I'm pointing at here?
Yeah, I think so. Although, I mean, one thing I'll say is, in a way, tying this back to what we were talking about before, resistance or whatever it is to Trump has been interesting because of how many conservatives and Republicans are in it, right? That is, it's often easy to see the face of this as being people on the left and they're worried about immigration or whatever it is, right? But I'm writing a book now on the Never Trump movement of Republicans who opposed Donald Trump, and many of them still continue to do so. And the interesting thing about that has been in some ways the most depolarizing phenomenon of the last 30 years, right? I'm working with and talking with lots of very conservative Republicans who have been brought together with Democrats precisely because they think there's some genuine constitutional emergency. These are people who are, you know, are people who are very conservative, who would love to support the Republican Party, but are terrified by what their party's done and throwing in with Trump. So that's why I don't think you can think about this as a entirely partisan phenomenon of the opposition to Trump, or simply people not accepting
I can see the point, but that doesn't address my concern. No. My concern is not about the fact that it's a partisan division. My concern is about the fact that by delegitimizing Trump, the person, because of characteristics that people are averse to, you also undermine the authority, the legitimacy, and the effectiveness of the office that he occupies. He's not always going to be in that office. I mean, when I pick up the newspaper and I read about our president is a liar, our president is an idiot, our president is a pervert, our president is a traitor. When I read that, I think our president may have to command our troops to go to war somewhere. So now a lying, perverted, traitorous idiot is directing us into war somewhere.
Right.
So now the capacity for us to act through the institutions that are there, which are the only means by which we have to react to the vicissitudes of global events, has been undermined. You're going to call it partisanship? I think hashtag never Trump Republicans are partisan. They're simply not left-right Democratic-Republican partisans. They're partisans in the sense that a world order, a political world order to which they have become accustomed, has been upended. So they can't order us to war in the Middle East based upon whatever their motives might have been, because they've got an arrangement which accommodates their concerns. They now have to go through somebody who can win an election without them, and they don't like it. That's completely different from Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
There's two ways to get at what you're saying. One is, you know, you're saying it's a problem that the United States is being commanded by someone that people are claiming is an idiot and is illegitimate and is a traitor. The other way to say it is it's a constitutional problem that the United States is in fact being governed by someone who seems incapable of having the bandwidth to deal with the complexity of the issues that he's dealing with. So I'll just give you an example. Earlier this semester, I taught Essence of Decision by Graham Allison.
Yes.
And so when you look at that, and you look at that, a situation that is not, you know, in some ways radically different than maybe the ones we're going to be facing with
North
Korea.
Let's tell people it's about the Cuban missile crisis.
It's about the Cuban missile
crisis. How the government handled that.
Right. Right. And an incredibly, detailed analysis of what was going on in the Cuban missile crisis. And the thing that really struck me in rereading that with the current situation in mind is, first of all, how much actual just tactile feel for the government apparatus that Kennedy had, right? There's all these parts where they're having to deal with the organization of the blockade, and Kennedy just had all this tactile feel for what a naval blockade actually was, because he'd actually served in the Navy, right? And had a very, I think, complicated understanding of how government works. And that meant he was able to make a number of decisions that turned out to be incredibly pivotal and kept the Cuban Missile Crisis from ending and, you know, us all being blown to bits. And all the evidence that we have so far of Trump, and again, taking not the most extreme interpretation of Trump, is he has a really severely narrow bandwidth for information. He's consciously told people not to give him information beyond a very small amount. He doesn't have any experience with government or the ways that bureaucracies work, and especially in a crisis, all those things are going to be very important. So again, whether you want to call that being, you know, ignorant or whatever, I mean, you know, or he's an idiot, I think it's certainly the case that I'm very worried about the combination of the power of the institution of the presidency that we've created, combined with someone with the lack of experience, and I would say incuriosity is not an unreasonable term to use for this president, at least where new forms of information, you look at what his sources of information are. They're not very encouraging. I think that's the kind of thing that could actually, that is not So highly partisan.
The presidential daily briefing is not very encouraging.
Well, I think one of the evidences is that he's tried to push back against the and this is one of the things he did very early on was to try to reduce the length, the intensity of the presidentially daily briefing to make it shorter.
You're reading tea leaves. It's entrail reading here. I mean, you know, evidence.
Well, that's all we've got. The quote, the evidence.
My point is, debase and degrade the office, and you harm the country not just for this guy's term, but going forward. Let me say this. Okay. I offer you the following hypothetical. Suppose Barack Obama gets elected after Trump has served whatever terms he's going to serve. I mean, we can imagine it. Okay. So now you got racists and Obama haters and never Obama types out there and whatnot. And the template has already been laid down. Columnists at major newspapers can devote every column for 4 years to pointing out how this America-hating, apologizing for our greatness, questionable about his commitment to anything, huckster, who is, I don't know if he's white, I don't know if he's black or whatever, the worst kind of anti-Obama screed.
I think you just described 8 years of Fox News, didn't you?
No, I didn't. Because, first of all, even if it were an accurate depiction of Fox News, it would only be Fox News. I'm talking about an entire 35 or 40% of the culture using all of its power in the media, skits on Saturday Night Live, ordinary newspaper columns. And I'm also talking about the withdrawal of the balancing or mitigating response from people who would say, that's the president of the United States. Open contempt for the occupant of the office undermines the effectiveness of the office, I'm trying to say, and would carry over. Anyway, my hypothetical was going to be, if you thought Fox News was bad between 2008, 9, and 2016, think about what it would have been if all the gloves had been taken off by the precedent having already been set by MSNBC, the New York Times, CNN, and so forth and so on, that if you think the president is is an idiot, is a pervert, is a serial, predator, is an idiot, is a traitor, Stephen. The president, duly elected by the processes that we have for determining who governs our country, is a traitor. His motives called openly into question, his presumption that he doesn't serve the interests of the country. Come on. I don't give a damn about Trump. I'm not defending Trump here. That's bad for us.
I'm trying to get around whether, though, the problem is that, in fact, we elected someone with those attributes, or whether the problem is that some people are pointing it out. But that's – I mean, so, again,
yeah,
my
what,
point
what,
is
– What I'm saying
– Let me answer, Glenn.
Go ahead. Okay.
The problem, in my view, is we have a constitutional crisis because we have a combination of – an office that is in some ways awesomely powerful compared to any political office in the history of mankind, right? And we have someone who is unusually unfit for it for very specific reasons that I gave before, right? We don't even have to get into the question of traitorous, right? That this office puts unusual, extreme demands on the person who holds it. In some ways, we've been very lucky, with a few exceptions, in avoiding, George W. Bush, who I had a lot of issues with, put his all behind it and didn't just view himself as a kind of performer. He thought it was a hard job that somebody had to do. And there's evidence. Yuval Levin, who's the very conservative editor of National Affairs, just recently had a piece out that makes the very serious argument that Trump seems to only really recognize the performative elements of the presidency and not the executive management parts. And that's the big job. That's the job every day. And if you don't do that, that creates a constitutional crisis, right?
So the other thing
I'll say is I do think, on the other hand, that the things that some people have done rightly in trying to push back or constrain the damage that Trump can do will have downstream consequences. And again, my friend David Frum has said this, right? That You know, there's been leaks from the intelligence service. Those are in some ways understandable.
You have finished, Stephen. Okay, I haven't finished.
I'm going to finish making my point. You had a number of lectures already, so I'm going to have one now. So the Trump has had a number. There have been a number of these leaks. If you think we're in exceptional circumstances, and I think there's reason to think that we are, those are, a judgment call acceptable. On the other hand, they create a major constitutional, institutional problem going forward, right? That is, who is going to trust engaging in diplomatic relations with the United States if they think the phone calls that they make with the President of the United States are going to get leaked by the intelligence service, right? What president is going to trust?
You're making my point, Stephen.
I think both points are right, though.
No, but I think the idea that fellow who gets himself elected president is so unfit, based upon what? Based upon innuendo, conjecture, extrapolation, archly partisan and vindictive characterization, so presumptively unfit that we'd even entertain the idea that employees of the government could subvert, acting illegally, the institutions of protocol for the secrecy of government machinations in order to stymie him. That's.
I mean, I think in some ways we just disagree with the underlying.
Yeah, I think
facts,
we do. I think we do.
I think we can suffer
somebody who gets up in the morning and tweets inanities and who watches cable television in the Oval Office. We can suffer such a person and can survive 4 years or 8 years because the government, as you know, is more than just this person in this office. We can suffer that without doing the kind of damage that I think we're doing to our core institutions by using, and it is partisan, the outcome of an election. I mean, after all, this is not only repudiation of Trump. It's not only about Trump. This is about the people who elected Trump. This is about our reaction to the fact that the country is no longer governable by an elite class that heretofore had taken their prerogatives for granted. So anyway, thank you for letting me say that.
All right. So
we disagree about that.
We definitely disagree about that. That's too bad.
After
the Mueller investigation is over, I'll be interested to see whether you still agree that this is all just fantasies concocted by people spinning nightmares in their brain. Right?
As far as I know, they got nothing. I'm waiting to hear something. They got nothing, as far as I know. Some so-and-so met with Ambassador Kristolyov and he didn't report it. As far as I know, they got nothing. But I'm waiting. I'm staying tuned.
All right.
You know.
Okay.
No, I was going to ask you about Al Franken.
Okay.
You want to tell me about whether or not Al Franken should step down from his seat as a senator from Minnesota? Because of accusations that he has behaved inappropriately with women? All right, let me make it easy for you.
Okay. Well.
Let me make it easy for you. How could we, and here we go again with Glenn Lowry off there in the crazy land. How could we possibly entertain the idea that an elected United States senator could be unseated because a decade ago he behaved inappropriately in his interactions with somebody? He grabbed their butt. Did I advocate butt grabbing? No, I don't believe I advocated butt grabbing. I don't believe I did. 10 years ago, he grabbed a butt. Let me say it a third time. I did not advocate it. I think it's wrong. Step down from the United States Senate. If he had 10 years ago flagrantly neglected to pay his parking ticket. I mean, flagrantly. Okay. If he had 10 years ago engaged in some, he had plagiarized a speech. If he was a recovering drug addict, if he had been a wide philanderer who 10 years ago had 6 extramarital relationships going on simultaneously, he wouldn't be asked to step down from his seat in the United States Senate. I don't believe anybody ever asked Ted Kennedy to do that. How could we possibly be entertaining the idea that that's an appropriate response in our politics? Is that really the way we want to run a railroad around here? Anybody serving at a high level of government is susceptible at any point in time to being unseated by unprovable allegations about their inappropriate behavior. Do you believe the women? If you don't believe them, you must be a part of the problem. I'm just asking, Stephen, tell us stupid okay. American politics.
So let me, okay, let me, so there's two possible interpretations. I'm going to loop around to Franken here rather than going straight at it. One is you could argue that there's a moral panic going on now about sexual harassment. I'm not convinced yet that there's a moral panic going on, right? The other way to think about this is that you've had a very large number of people. Clearly, when you look at start with Harvey Weinstein, we'll start with the case that nobody thinks is just moral panic, right? Clearly, there were dozens and dozens of women, seemingly almost every woman who went into Harvey Weinstein's office, who was in some way sexually harassed, humiliated, et cetera, by Harvey Weinstein. And yet, and it was an open secret in Hollywood, right, to the point that people actually did skits on it, right, or jokes that at least, referred to it obliquely. And nobody went forward. Nobody who was a victim of Harvey Weinstein went forward until somebody did, right? So this is you could see where the game theoretic point here is, right? That there's a kind of a belief that nobody's going to believe you, right? Or there's a belief that if you come forward, that you're going to be stigmatized or you're going to be attacked or the issue is going to become you. And therefore, everybody has an incentive not to be the person who does that, and that gives an enormous advantage to the people who are engaging in this abuse, right? And so one way to think about what the social dynamic that's happened really just over the last few months, is you've had a tipping point, right? Suddenly, right, lots of people who previously were just keeping everything in their head and thought that, that some degree humiliation or sexual harassment was the price of being in work, right, realize that they don't have to because somebody paid the first mover cost of going out there and being the person who said that they were harassed by Harvey Weinstein, whoever it was, right? And once that happens, then you do get a tipping point. Now, at some point, could that cycle that you're describing turn into a moral panic, right? Maybe, right? One of the problems is that we don't really clearly have much of a set of norms about what do you do with things that are short of of criminal behavior of the kind that Harvey Weinstein's was, right? What do you do about things that are just crude, right? Or were
Should Al Franken resign?
No. I think that's too simplistic a question, but I don't think it. But one thing is, one of our problems is we don't have much of a set of sanctions in this that are intermediate sanctions, right? We've either got the death penalty, or you have people getting away, right? In some ways, it might be useful to have a Truth and Reconciliation, commission for sexual harassment.
Oh, please, Stephen.
Let me finish rather than just dismissing me, Glenn. Let me actually make the point, which is that huge numbers of workplaces have, in fact, had norms where bosses simply got to engage in sexual humiliation of various sorts, and people thought it was something you had to deal with. Suddenly, you've got a cavalcade of people who are coming. And I hear from female women I know who are in Washington, very significant Washington positions that say this was essentially a tax they had to pay in almost every job they had. And they had to simply suck it up. What sanction do you do for that?
Hold on. For the record, behaviors that are being criticized here are wrong and deeply problematic, and the U.S. workplace for women ought to be free of them having to bear that burden. Though, in TELUS-like fashion, I would observe that the situation is more complicated than simply an issue of victims and predators. The sexual, social dynamic of American workplaces is, it strikes me, a very complicated and interesting phenomenon. And the use of sexuality and the possibility and potentiality of it is an instrument, as well as an instrument of making one's way in the world, as well as a opportunity for people who have power and who are gatekeepers to be able to exploit others who are seeking to advance. I think it's really quite complicated. How many people are married to people whom they met in the workplace? If we were to take those relationships and go backwards in time and trace how they evolved, how many of them would have involved interactions and circumstances which, if they were isolated and didn't end in the people actually ending up married to one another or in long-term relationships, consensual relationships, but taken out of that context, would appear to be inappropriate in the way in which we're describing here. Moreover, and I just finished, these are extra legal actions. Okay? We're not taught, you say, what should the penalty be? Well, courts decide penalties, not newspaper editorial boards, not social media movements.
Now, you know what I meant by penalty. We have penalties that are always extra legal. In this case, the question is, does somebody get to have an office? And we have to make a collective decision about that. And again, my position is there should be some sanction in his case short of removal for office. Although, again, I think it's perfectly legitimate for the voters in Minnesota to decide when in 2020 in a primary race if they think that balanced against his record or service. And I should say in the Franken case, this was devastating for me. I think Franken had a very reasonable shot at running for president in 2020. He's been a very effective senator. He's an awfully smart guy.
Let me just observe.
This is not a no-cost thing for me.
No cost. I mean, it's absurd. The idea that he would be now found to be ineligible and illegitimate to do this thing that you're talking about him doing, in virtue of the fact that, at least as far as I know, I'm just reading what I read in the newspaper, the things that he's alleged to have happened. The idea that that would foreclose the possibility that he could govern this country, that he could be a leader who would bring people together across the aisle, whatever it is that he would do, is absolutely absurd. It's completely disproportionate.
I agree that in this particular case, that sanction is not what I would have done.
There are 100 cases like this. There are 100 cases like this. I mean,
I think the real question is which direction do you think we're more likely to go to overcorrect in, right? You seem to be worried we're going to overcorrect in the direction of witch hunts for men. And I think in some ways we already, the status quo ante was that we were overcorrecting in essentially allowing workplaces dominated by men to humiliate women. Now, ideally, this would be a moment. Ideally, this would be a moment not for trying to go at individual people, but saying, look, clearly, one thing we've seen is there's a institutional problem here, right? The mechanisms in which we've tried to deal with sexual harassment don't seem to be terribly effective. We ought to figure out what that is. We ought to figure out what do you do with lots of things that are simply sort of scuzzy and but don't reach the level of crimes or civil penalties.
I'm very disappointed. Very, very disappointed, Steve. I thought you were harder headed than this.
I apologize for my soft-headedness. Speaking of soft-headedness,
Let me just say this thing very quickly. The financial industry is full of a lot of investment advisors whose dealing with their clients could be subject to question. If I started ostracizing people, clients come forward and they say, I sat with this guy, he was talking to me about my money. I have the feeling that he was really trying to take advantage of me because I was naive and whatnot. He used a lot of slick words and whatever, but at the end of the day, he took my money and he did this or that with it, and I felt like I wasn't fairly treated. And we were to allow testimony from individuals based on their unverifiable encounters with people to be the basis of, he can't be a CEO of this, chief financial officer of this company, he can't be assistant secretary of the treasury for this or that. Because 6 people came forward and said they didn't like the way he dealt with them when they went over there to try to borrow money to start their business. Nobody would find that to be acceptable.
The question of belief
sex
is
different.
Beside the fact the case in Franken, because I think at least so far Franken has not actually questioned the facts in any of the cases.
How dare he? Even if he had questions about the facts, he wouldn't dare question the facts. That would, of course, make him one of these people who question the facts.
That's of course, a witch it's also hunt. Possible. Maybe we're back to the earlier thing, but it's also possible that he actually did the thing of which he's being accused of doing, and he's not questioning it because he knows he got caught. He did something stupid. He was in, you know, the other thing with Franken, you know, he was in a different industry not that long ago, right? He was in an industry that is not a particularly wholesome one to produce people who are going to go into politics. And, you know, it's not a surprise to me that somebody who came out of that would end up having some of this stuff in their closet. But I think we'd have some other, I mean, again, I'm not sure we're quite as far apart as you think that, we shouldn't be kicking Franken out. We ought to have some social way to say, you know, that was humiliating. And also those kind of things multiplied over millions and millions of times does have social and institutional effects. But the idea that all we have is essentially the death penalty as a sanction seems like a bad idea. And I think that, again, that's aside from the question of, do we have some norm where we have to, you know, where we should always believe the women? That seems like a strange evidentiary standard that also doesn't deal with the fact that we know that women have the same distribution of moral character as men do, or at least
and
not
of
that
ambition.
Far off
of it. And yeah. Of ambition.
But I think that's not particularly the issue in this particular case. So,
well,
all right,
okay, Stephen.
All right, well, thanks for having me on. We'll see whether we can get as many sparks the next time we do this.
Thank you for putting up with my contrarian and obstreperous character.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.